Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, Gritty City, an oral history of Winnipeg hip-hop music, 1980 to 2005, out now. Nigel Weber, the author, joining me on the program to discuss it. Welcome to the show, Nigel.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. This book's been in the offing for a while. It's been out now for a bit. Maybe I want to start with kind of like reaction, because a lot of times I talk to an author kind of before a book is out and they don't have a sense of kind of how it's landing, but it's been out for a while. What's the reaction been?
Yeah, it came out this summer in August. So yeah, it's been a few months and been getting a really good reaction. Just this past weekend, I was vending at the Winnipeg punk rock flea market. So that was a really good opportunity to kind of get my face and, you know, and the book out there and, you know, running into people that I either didn't know or, you know, knew online or kind of had, you know, just sort of knew from around Winnipeg, and, you know, having them come up to me and say, oh, I heard about this and I'm really excited to get a copy and stuff like that. And I've also been connecting individually with a lot of people that I interviewed for the book to get them copies, and everyone has been really excited about it. You know, oftentimes I'll drop a book off to someone and then by the time I get home and, you know, look at my social media, they've already put up a post about, oh, check out this new book that I got, you know, so excited to get a copy of it. So yeah, definitely been really happy with the response thus far.
You mentioned, you know, dropping off to people that, you know, participated in interviews. This is a very participatory book, right? I mean, an oral history generally is. And I'm curious, like, did you ever think about telling this story in a way other than an oral history, or was this the obvious way to tell this?
No, it always, in my mind, was an oral history, going back to a number of influences. Number one being Sheldon Burney's book about local punk music, Missing Like Teeth, but also a number of other influences. The Legs McNeil book, Please Kill Me, about punk rock in the 70s, I guess. That was a big influence. You know, I read that book going back to when I was a teenager. So, and then the book about Yes, Yes, Y'all, the book about the earliest days of hip hop history in New York City, that was a huge influence as well. So yeah, it, you know, I always just had that sort of admiration for this style and wanted to be able to recreate it myself, while also feeling that it's the best way to really tell the story from the point of view of the people that are that have lived it. And that was really important to me.
So speaking of influences, you mentioned in the introduction, you see yourself as your style as a blend of Nardwuar and Robert Caro. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that.
Yeah. Nardwuar is, like, you know, definitely one of my biggest influences going back to the days, you know, he was on Much Music, and, you know, I was like, who's this weird guy with the hat and stuff, you know? I couldn't place him. But then later on, you know, YouTube came around, and that's kind of where I feel like he really found his footing, and where I had kind of rediscovered him. And just the inanity of his research at times is, you know, it's like, how do you even think to ask about some of these things that he knows so in depth about people, you know, like restaurants they've been to, or, you know, like, how do you think about this stuff, especially, you know, some of the pre-internet days? So yeah, you know, just that level of specificity and detail, you know, it always is so, it really reflected also how the way I think and my brain works. I'm not quite as sort of manic and, you know, extroverted as Nardwuar. I'm much more contained and introverted, but that same sort of passion for the details and the information runs through me. And then, yeah, I'm also a huge reader. I read a lot of nonfiction, and I don't think there's any nonfiction writer out there who does the kind of, you know, in-depth research as Robert Caro. You know, he moved to Texas to, you know, in the process of writing his Lyndon Johnson book for a chapter. He moved across the country for 3 years so that he could properly get the reactions of people for a single chapter. in a single volume of his 5-volume series. You know, that like that level of dedication is just so, I don't want to say extreme, but you know, it's outside of the norm of dedication that an author or researcher would go to. But you know, it's those sorts of inspirations that I draw from that, you know, talking to 120 people for this book, you know, seems like a simple task in comparison to, you know, moving my family across the country to, you know, get a chapter.
So you didn't uproot yourself for this book. But...
No. But the, you know, the benefit now versus when Mr. Caro was writing that book in the 70s is technology. And a lot of the research for this project, the heavy research was done in the COVID lockdown days. You know, I was ready to go kind of right before it happened and stuff with, you know, having done a lot of research, and I was lining up to do all my interviews in person. But then when I wasn't able to, and I had a lot of free time, you know, I'd been laid off in 2020, and, you know, I just started hopping on the phone with people and just made, you know, I made a lot of headway that way, just talking to people through those, you know, lockdown days when we couldn't go anywhere.
So that obviously freed time up for you to pursue this. It sounds like it also maybe made people available to participate.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially when a lot of, you know, I'll use an example of McEnroe from Peanuts and Corn. You know, he lives in Vancouver and he works in the film industry. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, he's working super long days. And then on his off days, I mean, he's a family guy. So, but I caught him at the time when, you know, all the film sets in Vancouver were shut down. So he was off for however many weeks. And, you know, if that hadn't have happened, it might have been way more of a scheduling headache to try to, you know, squeeze that in. But it, you know, it came at a good time and we were able to, you know, bang out like 20 hours or something of interviews in not very much time at all.
So the similarity between Nardwuar and Caro is the preparation, like the research and the preparedness and the level of specificity of detail. What did that research process look like for you leading up to interviews? Like, did you pull archival materials or does like one interview prepare you then for successive interviews when you're talking to a specific person or about a specific event? Like, how did that take shape?
Definitely a bit of both. Early interviews definitely helped inform later ones, but I was pretty ready to go before I had even started interviews. A big part of that process was digging through the physical archives of Stylus magazine. At the time, I was a contributor to Stylus, so I would go to the office and, you know, pick out the... I was doing it kind of roughly in chronological order, so the first 10 issues and take them home and flip through them and scan them and bring them back and take the next 10 and so on. So from that, I was able to get a lot of dates, which is helpful to be able to kind of cross-reference things. And then there's also a lot of, you know, coverage, you know, profiles, that sort of thing of different groups at different times. And so that helped, again, with dates and also with, you know, more specific questions. I was also, this was actually interrupted by the pandemic, but I've been at the Manitoba Archives digging through their collection of Uptown magazine. Again, that was helpful for dates and some of that sort of stuff. And then, yeah, just online, you know, going through, you know, music videos and just listen, you know, a lot of it, I mean, it's music, right? So you have a lot of it is just listening to the music, trying to find the music online. You know, a lot of stuff now is on Bandcamp, but some of it, you know, is trying to track it down on just, you know, single YouTube videos and stuff like that. So that was a lot of the research as well.
So it sounds like you built like a timeline based on kind of the Stylus magazines and the Uptowns that like you had a sense of kind of like who was involved at certain points that then you could kind of track those people down?
Yeah, I definitely, still have that timeline. I still go back to it every now and then just to check out for reference. And yeah, I'd have a master interview list. I would just, you know, that's kind of roughly by era that the people were involved in. And, yeah, it was just kind of slowly checking names off that list. You know, one person led me to the next usually. So
in terms of, you know, like you've got this timeline, does that help in terms of writing the book at the end of it? Like that you have kind of something to hang all the bits on, or is it a trickier thing still to organize the book as it exists, even though it runs in a chronological fashion?
No, by the time I kind of got to the actual writing stage, it's like the timeline was more like, it's more just ingrained in me at that point. So I know when things roughly happen, you know, and the book is roughly chronological. There's some elements that sort of, you know, the chapter, one chapter kind of follows its logical end, which will bring you to a little bit later, which is, you know, and then the next chapter starts with a new group or a new whatever that goes back a bit earlier. So it was more about kind of putting it together, yes, in chronological order, but also, you know, say around the year 2000, there's about 8 to 10 chapters that are all kind of based in that year or around that year, something happening in that time. So at that point, it's sort of figuring out more stylistically, more, you know, based on clarity and that sort of thing, the order that I should put them in. So it's a bit of both, I guess.
And then in terms of writing specific chapters, like obviously you're, as an oral history, you're relying on a lot of other voices to tell the story, but you're framing things. How conscientious are you of like kind of like authorial voice and like interjecting or, you know, setting things up too cleanly? Like how much thought do you give to like how often you're writing and it's your voice in the book?
Yeah, I definitely tried to make my voice less frequent. You know, I want, you know, the point of my voice in the book is to make sure that things are clear. As I mentioned earlier, there's a number of different oral histories that I had been inspired by, you know, so, and each of them are kind of presented in slightly different formats. So for example, the Please Kill Me about early punk rock, there's little to no author interjections or setups, but it's a little bit different because, you know, almost no matter who you are, you're picking up the book, you know who Lou Reed is, you know who Johnny Ramone is, you know, you understand who these characters are, most of them, outside, you know, without having to have a whole lot of exposition. But I don't think that's the case with Winnipeg Hip Hop. I think most people are going to need to be explained who is this individual that is speaking, and why is it important that they're telling me this information. So that's a big part of what the setups that I'm trying to write are, is especially early on. I mean, by the end of the book, you know who Odario is, and I don't need to set him up every time. But earlier on, especially the first number of times someone is introduced in the book, they need to be introduced properly so that the reader can understand. I also always, through the process of writing it, was thinking in my mind, is my mom going to understand this? My mom's a huge reader. I don't know anyone who reads more books than she does, but she doesn't know anything about hip hop. She doesn't know anything about local hip hop. So when my mom's reading this book, is she going to understand it? Is she going to get the references? Is she going to, you know, understand, you know, what I'm talking about here? So I tried to kind of have that sort of audience in mind and not have it be too like in the weeds of hip hop or music or that, you know, or even of the era, you know, trying to explain different era specific things and also kind of help put you in the context of larger hip hop at the time. You know, I would say like, oh, you know, the year is 1994, you know, Nas Illmatic just came out, you know, Biggie Ready to, you know, putting the context of, you know, what's happening around in the world of these people that you're reading about.
So speaking of the world that folks are reading about and some of the context, I was fascinated by the bit about the Craig Mack show.
Right.
Which I didn't live in the city at that point. And so this was my like kind of introduction to this like ill-fated show. Was this something you knew about beforehand, or was this something you discovered in the process of like talking to people?
No, yeah, I I did not know about it beforehand. It was, yeah, it was definitely something I learned about in the process. Chris Knight, who was one of the main organizers for that show, was one of the first people I interviewed, though. So I suppose I learned about it quite early on in the process.
And was that something like he brought up, like when you were asking about like shows he put on, or like how did your knowledge of that kind of come about? Because then you do get, you know, like Honeycutt to weigh in on having attended it. Alan Lord was there. Like you get other people to kind of like give context to what that show was about and why it was kind of a disaster.
Yeah. I suppose I don't remember the exact context of how Chris would have brought it up to me, but the show was put on by his production company at the time, Mad Flavor Productions. And that was kind of their whole goal in 1994, 1995, was, you know, we're going to put on as many events as we can and save all the money that we can from those events so that we can bring Craig Mack, or I don't know if originally it was Craig Mack that they, you know, that they knew from, you know, day one that it was going to be Craig Mack or just an American rapper, but that was their goal kind of from starting their production company, was let's throw a bunch of shows with the intention of saving all the money to bring in a big out of town rap act. And so it was Craig Mack. And this is, yeah, the show happens April 15, 1995.
So was there, I mean, I know there was one person you wanted to talk to that unfortunately you couldn't because Jerry Atwell passed, but was there anyone you approached that didn't want to talk for the book?
Not very many. And I, you know, for their own personal sake, I'd prefer not to say who.
Sure.
But yeah, there was a few.
Amongst those who did talk, like, did you have to draw certain things out of folks, or were they all pretty willing participants in this?
I would say everyone is a willing participant. I do think that, you know, and I mean, I think this is just the case with people in general. You know, some people are talkers and some people are not. You know, some people gave me a lot of, you know, two word answers, you know, oh yeah, I remember that. Like, that was a good show. You know, that was fun. And then some people I started the interview with, so how did you get your start? And then they stopped talking an hour later by, you know, having gone through their entire career. So yeah, I think it really just depends on the individual. You know, some people, especially some of the older folks from like the 80s generation, they were just, you know, waiting for someone to knock on their door, so to speak, to come to them with this kind of interview. You know, like, you know, they some of them in fact had been out of the music industry for decades, but, you know, were like, oh yeah, you know, those were important days, you know, I've been waiting for someone to come around to talk to me about it. So yeah.
So then in an instance like that, like, you know, thinking back to some of the older stuff, like the Blackorama or Blockorama it was originally called, like did these folks still have like the materials that you end up using, like the photos and things like that?
A little bit, yeah. Definitely a lot of the preservation of that older generation of archival material is through DJ Bunny. He kept a lot of stuff. Sounds like he kind of has lost some stuff over the years that he originally had, but yeah. And, you know, a lot of stuff he has just already up online and stuff. So, yeah, a lot of it came from DJ Bunny. And he was my first interview. He's, you know, the biggest cheerleader of Winnipeg hip hop and, you know, this project and everything about Winnipeg hip hop really. So yeah, it was only natural.
Yeah, I definitely got the sense in reading this book that, like, I don't know, it wouldn't necessarily be what it is without Bunny.
No, not at all.
Because it also sounds like he put you in touch with several people.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, he was my first interview back in February 2020, right before the world stopped. And yeah, he, you know, at a certain point, he kind of, you know, I was sort of well on my way, but a lot of those early connections he helped me make, which then I kind of would follow up with those people and follow up, you know. But say, you know, 2 or something years into it, when I was getting closer to the end of having done most of the interviews, I went back to GJ Bunny and said, is there anyone else you think I should talk to, you know, who I've missed, or that kind of thing? And yeah, he always, you know, always was willing to help.
Going back to Nardwar, he, you know, one of his big things is like surprising the person with just how prepared he is. And and rarely is he himself surprised. But I'm curious if you had any instances where something someone said surprised you, like that you took something away from something that you didn't necessarily have the context or knowledge of.
Yeah, especially early on. I would say that sort of the more and more interviews I did and the more research I did, the less that sort of happened. But it, yeah, it was definitely a few, you know, a few of those early on. You know, where you realize some connection or something like that. But yeah, I'm not thinking of one off the top of my head.
Sure enough. I want to ask you a little bit about kind of the framing overall and the fact that this ends in 2005. Was that like a natural choice to end it where you do with the PNC 2.0, or like, did you struggle with kind of how to wrap this book up?
Yeah. All the way through the interview process, and up until about halfway through writing the book, I intended to end it in 2015. So I had done a number of interviews. You know, say if I talked to someone like Pipskid, you know, I talked to him about his career all the way up until 2015. Not 2005, because that was the original goal, you know. And so I've also done interviews with people who aren't in this part one, say like the Lytics, a lot of people from Streets FM. But as I was writing the book, I started to see the page count go up and up. You know, I knew what I had left to write, and I just, you know, and I knew what would be entailed in going all the way up to 2015. It just, you know, the options were put out a 400 page book, you know, at minimum, which would be untenable for both myself as the self-published author and the most readers, through, you know, cost concerns. So I could have done that, or I could have started cutting what I felt were very important chapters. Or what I ended up deciding on is I'm going to do a part two, that will cover at least that last decade of 2005 to 2015. Depending how ambitious I am, I might take it further, say up to the pandemic. But like I said, I've done a lot of the legwork already for that part two up to 2015. And that's also a, you know, a nice, 2015 is a nice endpoint if you sort of know this, what's going on in the scene. You know, there's a lot of important things that happen in the, I mentioned in the book, in the 2008 to 2013 era, you know, Winnipeg's Most, the Lytics, Streets FM, Marathon of Dope, Len Bowman goes solo, I could go on and on. There's a lot that happens in that era. But a lot of that sort of, you know, by 2015, Winnipeg's Most has broken up, you know, Streets is off the air, the Lytics are on like a indefinite hiatus. You know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of things have kind of had a natural wrap up at that point, sort of like in 2005. So anyway, at some point there will be a part two. I actually have been just starting to kind of pull some of that material together for some early chapters on that. So yeah, part two will be forthcoming at some point.
You'd mentioned about the page count. That does make the question, like editing for a book like this, when it's an oral history, like is it a different thing than like editing when it's all original material like that you've written? Like, do you find that you have to be judicious in a different way to edit someone else's voice?
Yeah, you know, I will say that I definitely edit the the transcribed interviews of different people for clarity and length, taking out the you knows and the likes and false starts and that sort of thing. You know, taking a set, you know, if say they start a idea and then go off on a tangent and then bring the idea up again later, combining the two, that sort of thing. So they are edited together, absolutely. But yeah, it definitely is, you know, I mean, I also, to be fair to myself, this is the first book that I've written. So I don't have the other side of that. I haven't written a book that is entirely my own voice. So I suppose I'm maybe not the best judge in that regard. But no, I wouldn't, you know, for me, the most enjoyable process, parts of this whole process were the writing and editing of it. So I guess I'll put it that way.
Sure. Yeah. I was just curious because I knew you'd written for Stylist that like it wasn't all like just Q&A style. Sure. So like you have some experience.
Sure. Yes.
You know, with the editing process when it's your own words. So yeah.
No. Yeah. Fair enough. I guess not. I was thinking, I guess, longer form. But yeah. So as far as that goes, you know, it's, I guess for the editing, it's trying to find a way for myself to be there as little as possible. If I don't have to say it in my own words, if someone else can say it for me, then I'd prefer that. You know, if I have, you know, if I can do it quicker in a shorter number of words, then I might have to do that. But ideally, I'm not the one telling you the information. I'm just sort of setting it up and giving the context of the place and time and person that's speaking.
Right. That goes back to you being kind of like the context concierge. Did your mom end up reading it?
Yes, she did.
Did it work for someone who doesn't know the Winnipeg hip hop scene like you do?
Yeah, I think so. I think it, you know. Again, you know, it's from my perspective, it's I'm so ingrained in it. But yeah, you know, I would say that that it's I've been hearing from a lot of different people, including, you know, say family, friends, that kind of thing, who haven't bought it, and, you know, family. And yeah, it's been a good reaction from all sides.
All right. Well, Gritty City, An Oral History of Winnipeg Hip Hop Music, 1980 to 2005, out now. Congratulations on its release, and thanks for taking some time to talk about it, Nigel.
Thank you for having me.